Dragon
by Don Howarth. With Robert Stevens as George, Alan Bennett as Thesaurus, Cyril Shapps as the King, Pauline Letts as the Queen, David Timpson as Amalric, and Stephen Thorne as the narrator, Alcuin. In the popular legend of St. George and the Dragon, St. George prevails in single combat, and the wounded dragon is led into the city and beheaded. But that is only one version of the story, and told, moreover, from only one side.
The story I am to tell is about the contention between ourselves and mankind on the face of the earth, and of the contention within the hearts of many creatures stirred by that conflict. It is, above all, about my brother Amalric, a prince of dragons, he whose valor, love, and honor in the end brought upon himself and upon mankind and upon our nation a fate unthinkable in the days when it yet lay before us, inevitable now, when after many years we look back. I will speak first of those happy early days, and of our noble and beloved Uncle George, commander of the army, former dragon errant, and teller of stories to the young.
Tell us of your fight with a dinosaur, Uncle George.
And how you overcame the prides of lions.
And the packs of wolves.
And how you sizzled the ogres with the fur of your breath.
And dried up the haunts of the river trolls, filling the forests with steam.
Oh. Tell us how you defeated the armies of mankind.
Speak of unrequited love, Uncle George.
Oh, no.
Tell us about Melisande.
The fairest of the fair.
Except for me, Uncle George. You've said so.
And me.
And me.
The fairest of the fair present company excepted. Her eyes shone like the stars on a frosty night, and her scales...
Her scales were the colours of the sunlight seen in a spider's web.
And she walked with such grace that other creatures stopped to see her pass. And every dragon errant who passed that way would have ended his wanderings at her word. But although she was kind to all, she rejected all, because she was waiting for the dragon errant of her dreams.
Who, alas, was not you, Uncle George?
Who, alas, was not me.
Oh, Uncle George.
Why do you always ask him to tell you? You always weep.
It's so sad and beautiful.
Tell us about the whale.
The wily whale?
Oh, yes!
He sought to lure me into his element and turn me like a turtle in the deep sea currents.
Oh!
And I sought to draw him close to the ice.
Where you'd have breathed fire and made a fried fish of him.
We matched our wits for days. Watched by animals you'd never believe existed. Penguins and bears that are white, not brown. And seals like giant slugs that pop through the ice behind me. He once came in close, and I gave him a long, low blast of fire as you might when fighting reptiles.
A false move, Uncle George.
A false move indeed. It melted the ice in front of my forefeet, and I very nearly slithered into the sea.
Careless, Uncle George.
But you couldn't help it, Uncle George, because your thoughts were on her who had rejected you.
Quite so, my dear. And in battle, one must concentrate at all times. However, I was ready for him the next time up. I stood well back and let him have a blast that singed the hump of his spine.
But that didn't finish him off, Uncle George.
No, no. In the nature of things, we could not get to grips. We parted, honours even, quite good friends. He blew up a spout of water, which I hit with a blast of fire, and a great cloud formed, which sprinkled the white bears and the penguins with snow. And then passed on across the ocean to the tropical forests, where its rain made the bluebells grow to the height of turrets erected by mankind.
Oh. Oh. But you still had a broken heart, Uncle George.
Very much so, my dear. I took counsel with a very wise dragon, the Queen's cousin, Thesaurus.
Oh. Tell us about Thesaurus.
Well, as you know, he's a recluse. He lives in the mountains, alone,
had Uncle George.
And not always in the same place, because although he's very much opposed on ideological grounds to breathing fire at enemies, he sometimes does it absent-mindedly and sends his own lair up in smoke. But he's very clever and can understand other creatures. And what is most unusual, he has a friend from mankind whose name is...
Hermes!
Funny name, but nice, tame creature.
Uncle George, don't talk about Hermit. You were telling us about unrequited love.
I beg your pardon, my dear. That, of course, was what I had gone to consult Thesaurus about.
Go on, Uncle George. Imitate Thesaurus.
Oh, yes, 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 George.
Well, George, it would seem to me that you could hardly accept a permanent emotional bondage, since as a dragon errant, certain things are required of you, to wit, to engage in endless combats, to perform gallant and good deeds, without defining too closely what may be meant by these words, and in the course of your peregrinations, to form what are known as attachments. Now, what was it you were asking?
What does that mean, Uncle George?
I don't really know.
I will now speak of mankind. Mankind is puny, but large in numbers, and they scurry about driven by a passion to change the appearance of the creation. They fell woods, raise fodder, and erect cities. They greatly favour straight lines. The walls of their lairs are straight, and perhaps because there's no comfortable hollow to support the curve of their backs, they don't sleep long at night, seldom in the day, and never hibernate as we do, which makes them bad-tempered, so that they frequently shout and flail at each other. They grow their fodder in lines. They march to battle in lines, and also in lines bring back the captives, their enemies among mankind, and beasts of distant lands. Sometimes they arrange themselves in lines and shuffle behind a man in a long robe who holds aloft a plank bearing the figure of a dead man without a robe.
Perhaps that man inherited the robe from the hoisted man, Uncle George.
Well, yes. I remember hearing something of the sort from Thesaurus.
But why are they parading across the fields, Uncle George?
I believe it's to help their fodder come up.
I'm able to speak with some knowledge about mankind, because in those days we dwelt within sight of the city, a peaceful arrangement whose origin was explained by my father, the Dragon King, to myself, Alcuin, and to my elder brother, Imalric.
When I was young, only shortly after the beginning of time, the great battle was fought between the dragons and the armies of mankind.
In which Uncle George played a distinguished part.
A most distinguished part. We prevailed. But the great forest of my father's kingdom was desolated by fire from the mountains to the sea. Fodder would never grow there again. So we set forth to find a new kingdom. And when we reached this forest, we stopped. It is, as you know, not perfect. It lacks a broad river, and its buttercup meadows are few. Mm. But we had with us the wounded of the battle, my father amongst them. And the young, who were drowsy because the autumn was by now well advanced. My father called a halt. It was then dusk, and I remember our surprise when darkness fell at seeing low on the horizon what seemed like a cluster of stars and proved to be, as you know, a city of mankind. Mm. It was occupied by a species which had not taken part in the battle, and at daybreak we saw that the fields where they raised their fodder extended to the forest where we had halted. Some, like Thesaurus, sickened by battle, urged my father to move on. Others, mainly the dragon's errand...
Who can never have enough of fighting.
Oh, that's rather harsh, my dear. Who did, however, urge the incineration of the city. My father was wiser than both. We merely made a show of our strength, deployed along the edge of the forest. Mm. The king brought his stone-throwing machines close to the top of the wall, and his warriors on horseback formed into line along the bottom. But they did not move towards us, and we did not move towards them. And when the cold of winter came, most of them went back into the city, and most of us dozed off into hibernation. When spring arrived, mankind, in ones and twos at first, returned to the fields. We took care to cause them no alarm. They, on their side, left us in peace in the forest, and when the harvest was gathered, they offered us trifling gifts of fodder.
But we still post guards during hibernation and clear the fire lines through the trees in spring. Yes.
We maintain vigilance, Amalric. One can never wholly trust mankind.
They are strange. Alone of creatures, they destroy their own kind and forever seek a dominion over the world, which their puny strength makes absurd.
But that urge to conquest contributed fortuitously to the accommodation we've reached. Our victory over the rest of the armies of mankind, of which the king of the city quickly heard, enabled him to establish himself with little resistance as master of many cities of the world, and at the same time warned him of the destruction we could bring upon him if we were not allowed to recover in peace.
What my cousin Thesaurus called a balance of terror.
Which is his quaint way of speaking of years of peace, and indeed a sort of friendship.
Father, when the king of the city has established his dominion over the whole of mankind, he will then be very powerful.
Yes, Amalric, he will.
Do you not think he may then turn against us with armies as great as those your father defeated in the Battle of the Forest?
He may. It's a thing I often wake up in the middle of December and lie thinking about.
Will you tell us about the Battle of the Forest?
Oh, I played very little part. It was all roaring and flames and confusion to me. Ask George, he knows.
But he only gives a funny account to make the young laugh.
Then laugh, my son. You're still young.
I will now speak of my brother, the gentle and noble Amalric, elder son of the king our father, but destined never to succeed him.
Amalric, the little men are coming out of the city to knock each other off their horses.
Amalric, come with me to the headland. The king's vessels are returning.
Amalric, look, the bluebells.
The young followed him everywhere, and to each he gave his attention, though he was rather shy, and often went alone, wandering about the mountain. He would help anybody, and was rather imposed upon by some dragons. One old toothless female, Fippa, for whom he once collected fodder, summoned him every week thereafter, and was most exacting.
Amalric, you've brought too much sycamore amongst it.
I'm sorry, Fippa.
The beech saplings were very nice. What happened to them?
Finished, I'm afraid.
Oh, there must be some more in all this forest.
I'll look again.
So wretched to be old, Amalric. You're at such a disadvantage when you've lost your choppers.
Creatures of every species knew him. He would slow his pace or change his direction, as Uncle George did, to avoid startling the more timid of them, such as the sheep and the foxes. And on the fell side he trod carefully to spare the nests of birds. The children of mankind who came to play in our forest tried in their funny way to speak his name, and the adults working in the fields looked up to salute him as he passed. These fights began one day when Uncle George called Amalric out to help in his comic demonstrations of overcoming wild pigs and river trolls or vanquishing the armies of mankind. As Amalric had grown in age and grace, he'd also grown in strength and swiftness. He could turn like an eel and strike like a serpent. And although he couldn't yet breathe fire, he gave Uncle George a good contest in flameless combat. Because of their good nature and the pleasure each took in the other's craft, they seldom lost their temper, but their struggles would flare ferociously, alarming us lest they kill each other.
Stop him! Stop him!
That's enough of the threat! Well done!
Thank you, Uncle George.
Good fight!
Amalric, I do not approve of all this fighting.
I'm sorry, Father.
It is most unseemly to come to your mother bleeding and with branches and bracken in your scales.
I beg your pardon, Mother.
And that's another thing, Amalric. You have become excessively courteous.
I beg pardon for that too, Mother.
No one holds the dragon's errant in higher esteem than we do.
We are much in their debt for our past victory over mankind and the security of our present kingdom.
It is not a suitable career for a lifetime.
I do not have an ambition to be a dragon errant, much as I admire them.
Well, there you see, my dear. I told you. Any young dragon of Amalric's age becomes fond of frisking around.
Except that Amalric is extraordinarily good at it and might easily be misled in...
No, Mother. I shall not be misled. I understand my duty to the kingdom, and I understand it is not my fate to become a dragon errant.
You will be a better king than I.
I am sure not, Father.
I was, as you know, quite young when my father died from the effects of his wounds, and the duty of establishing this kingdom fell upon me. I had travelled nowhere except to come here from the old kingdom. I'd seen nothing except the terror and the desolation of the battle against mankind. I am limited and rather dull, which is why dragons errant seldom stay long here.
They do not stay because you are too prudent to make war and too formidable to be attacked.
This is the fairest of kingdoms, Father.
Oh, all right. Thank you, but... the points I wanted to make, proceeding in my usual plodding manner, were first to ask for your reassurance about this dragon errant business.
Which I most readily give.
And then to say that before you do your time in the army, you should broaden your experience by a journey across the face of the earth.
Oh.
There are a number of diplomatic visits I should like made. George would be the best emissary.
Marvelous.
He has, unlike the errants we were speaking of, settled down and stayed at my side ever since my father's death.
He has applied himself most assiduously to the construction of the defences and the training of the army.
But, of course, in any old errant, the wanderlust stirs. And now that peace seems assured, as far ahead as we can reasonably see, I intend to release him to make this journey for his pleasure and for the instruction of yourself and your brother Alcuin.
I will now speak about our journey across the face of the earth. Like everything which is intended to be kept secret, our departure was known to every animal in the forest, and we were accompanied on the first day by many creatures. The only one who had not heard was Fippa, the toothless old dragoness who lived alone where the forest thins on the shoulder of the mountain.
What's all this, George? Surely you're not bent on resuming errantry at your age.
Not in the least. Just a turn, you know, across the face of the earth.
Oh, I suppose that's harmless enough. If you should visit the old kingdom, do you remember where I had my lair?
Indeed I do.
I should be glad if you could bring me back a description of how it looks today. It commanded such a good view of the river.
Will you fight dinosaurs, Uncle George?
In large numbers.
And dry up the horns of the river trolls, filling the forest with steam.
We shall seek every occasion.
And wolves, Uncle George, and lions and herds of elephants.
Whenever they cross our path.
But Uncle George, there might be too many for just three of you.
Then you will know how to die nobly in battle, won't you, Uncle George?
George, we have expressly commanded you to avoid that kind of thing.
Will you form attachments, Uncle George?
Not myself, in middle age and with my gammy leg. I'll leave that to Amalric.
That kind of thing is most emphatically to be avoided, George.
By now we had reached the crest of the ridge which formed the boundary of our kingdom. My father stopped, and all the dragons with him. The hares and rabbits, playful creatures ignorant of protocol, continued to scuttle round us as we descended into the valley. But one by one they hesitated and pricked up their ears and went back. And when we reached the river, the birds swooped over us in a last wide arc. There the path divides. One fork follows the river up the wooded valley. We took the other, which crosses the water and twists up the side of the mountain. From the summit of the first rise, we looked back, and the male dragons, tiny now on the ridge opposite, breathed fire into the air by way of parting salute. Climbed on, round the shoulder, and up into the clouds. not meet a whale, nor come across the river trolls, and all we saw of the dinosaur was its footprints in the snow. We had several alarming encounters, but Uncle George avoided combat, often by simply turning aside. One day, wild boars came to the edge of a forest we were skirting. A snout would poke through the undergrowth and withdraw as we approached.
How many would you say we have on our flank, Amalric?
Large numbers. Perhaps a whole nation, Uncle George.
Or perhaps just one who runs parallel to us and sticks his head through the undergrowth 1,000 times.
Perhaps just one.
Watch other quarters.
Uncle George changed course to take us wider of the forest, and nothing came of the incident. And once, beyond the last pine forest, when Amalric spotted wolves on the horizon of the snowfield, we simply faced them and stood our ground, and they broke and turned and went. We turned also and resumed our journey across the face of the earth. Now speak of our visit to the Old Kingdom and of George's account of the great battle there in which the dragons defeated the armies of mankind.
This ridge was the frontier of the Old Kingdom, and when day breaks, we shall be able to see almost the whole of the battlefield.
I have wanted to see this all my life, Uncle George.
It is a sight both of you should see and remember. It is not one that you will enjoy.
No. I have never quite understood why the battle developed on such a scale.
When the sun comes up, you will see the broad river which stretches the length of the horizon from the foot of the mountains to the marshes near the sea. There was a shallow crossing place approached through the forest by a wide swathe of open ground. And though it lay in your grandfather's kingdom, mankind had crossed the river there from the beginning of time. Mm. But then the emperor of mankind, not the king we know in the city, but an earlier one from elsewhere, had conquered the greater part of the world.
He must have been very powerful, Uncle George.
Indeed. And was bent upon some further conquest, which, put briefly, required that he should take over the crossing place and make it fit for the passage of whole armies. Mm. Your grandfather was not, of course, prepared to permit that.
Understandably. But it seems a small matter to lead to such terrible results.
Indeed, when the sun comes up, you will see what was once a great forest. Now, a wasteland more desolate than any desert or tundra we have ever crossed.
Dawn struck the river and crept first across a broad beach of sand and thence across a great forest of young trees from which thousands of birds rose singing into the sky.
I would never believe that the forest could have grown again.
Perhaps you would prefer not to talk about the battle today.
Uncle George didn't reply, but stared at the beautiful young forest beneath us. The light spread beyond the trees, across meadows bright with autumn flowers, across bounding streams, and up to the limestone outcrops of the fellside. The sun's warmth fell upon us at the top of the ridge.
I am very pleased. I am very pleased indeed. The Earth's recovery from what we did makes it easier to tell how we came to do it. The sun did not strike through quite so quickly the day the battle began. There had been a heavy mist during the night when we had taken up position along the line of the stream you see this side of the meadows.
Yes.
Mankind faced us in a line, ranged the whole length of these hills we're standing on now. The emperor first sent against us a dusky species we had never seen before, their horses flank to flank, moving down through the morning mist, and they attacked us in a manner which caught us utterly by surprise. Instead of charging in a solid line with lance, they broke ranks in the range of our fire and swooped through our ranks as fast as eagles and as sinuous as serpents, hitting us with a storm of arrows.
Uncle George.
Then, as we became more competent in coping with their charges, covering the ground with roasted horses and mankind. The mist cleared, and we saw new armies coming over the ridge. They were of a pink species, and they brought up great machines for firing stones and giant bows for shooting iron.
Like the king has round the city walls.
Exactly, but larger and in enormous numbers. They concentrated the fire of many machines upon small sectors of our line. Then, through the shrieking riders, through the gaps, we lost many dragons. And at nightfall, we withdrew into the forest all along the line.
But did that not limit the dragon's use of fire?
It did, but it deprived mankind of the best use of horses and catapults. We had a good day striking them down or roasting them with short blasts as they tried to penetrate between the trees.
Why then did you fall back all the way to the Broad River?
It was Kogan's intention that we should. Every night he gave up ground we had fought bitterly during the day to defend, and he deliberately weakened our center by moving many dragons, of whom I was one, out of the battle completely. For days we listened to the fighting and watched the reinforcements of mankind pouring over these hills, idling away our time on the river bank far to the south.
And the whole force was thrown against the dragons on the beach.
Well, now we've called it a beach, but at that time, it wasn't sand as it is now. It was a solid river bank, and there were trenches in it made by the river when it was in flood. It was, in fact, more defensible than the meadows. Though, of course, they could use their swift horses to some degree, and their machines pounded away day and night. Many dragons perished, and the bridgehead...
Oh, Uncle George.
Then Kogan made his long-planned move. He threw in the reserve he had formed. Some swam upriver and reinforced the defenders on the river bank. The rest, much the greater part of our force, marched a short distance inland and swung into the forest, where at daybreak we linked up with the force Kogan had formed north of the battlefield. The whole army of mankind, the Emperor himself, all their machines, all their horses, the whole array of their power on earth, except for a few ox carts gone to collect boulders, lay in a narrow belt of forest between us and our forces on the river bank. We set fire to the trees. The wind at our back sent the flames roaring into the armies of mankind. Those who did not perish in the trees, we finished off as they emerged on our side or attempted to cross the open beach on the other. But then, in the very hour of victory, fate exacted as the price of their annihilation the destruction of our kingdom. The wind, freshening and cruelly changing direction, drove the flames inland and set the whole forest ablaze. We came up this hill with the hares and foxes and lesser creatures scuttling at our feet in thousands, and escaped horses running wild, and the air black with startled birds. And from here, we watched the kingdom burn.
Uncle George took us down to the old kingdom. The wide lane to the river was overgrown with brambles and blocked in places with the remains of those machines, which, being in the open, had escaped the worst of the fire. Bright fungus grew on the fallen beams, and moss covered the heaps of boulders beside them. In the woods lay skeletons of horses and oxen and of mankind's warriors. Flowers grew from charred skulls. I saw many skeletons of dragons, some holed where boulders had pounded through them, and some raised into ungainly postures by the regrowth of the trees. Uncle George was right in saying that there had been no beach by the river. The bank was indeed of dark earth, but so covered with bones that from the distance of the ridge we had mistaken it for sand. The wind now carried the leaves of another autumn across it, and migrating birds were gathering above the river. We left the old kingdom and went up into the hills and found a cave for hibernation. When I awoke in early spring, Amalric was already out in the snow, breathing fire at branches and icicles.
Uncle George! Huh? Amalric can breathe fire!
Can what?
Breathe fire!
Short winter. Ooh! All right,
then. Let's see you melt some snow.
Oh, now, no,
get your head down. Clear a path.
I don't know whether I...
Come on, Amalric. You've wakened us up at this unearthly month. At least you can clear us a path from the cave.
Well...
No, see.
Take a deep breath in. Compose yourself and... Your turn. Better. Again. Again, Amalric. And blow this time. That's better. Let's go. We'll play a trick on Thesaurus when we get there. We'll melt all the snow outside his cave. Thesaurus.
Huh?
Wakey, wakey. Rise and shine.
What? George?
You've overslept, Thesaurus.
Possibly. But is that sufficient cause, George, for this outburst of rowdyism? What brings you here this time? Broken leg or a broken heart?
Neither, Thesaurus. But what about yourself? I'm grieved to see you laid up in the middle of summer.
The middle of summer?
Look!
Oh, the snow's gone. Oh, what am I to do, George? I had matters to cogitate upon.
Then you must cogitate at the double.
I'm afraid, George, there's nothing in thought analogous to a forced march. Oh, dear. I promised to return to the valley by April. A wild boar is expecting me, and my friend Hermit...
I think you might, Thesaurus. Come outside.
I see.
This is Amalric. And Alcuin, the sons of the king.
And this, my young friends, is a prank which for a former errant is of surpassing subtlety. I must congratulate your father on having appointed as your instructor a dragon of such delicate sensibility. Anyway, we'd better descend to the valley. There's no fodder up here.
It was a most delightful walk down through the snow and the young bracken and the budding wood. Everywhere animals and birds came out to greet Thesaurus, and he spoke to all of them in their own tongue, but often forgetting their names and using a wrong one, which caused the amusement of an often repeated joke.
Of course, I really only know odd words of theirs, and I suspect a great deal of their pleasure arises from the grotesque way in which I pronounce them. But as you see, we do have some understanding, and they only banish me to the nippy heights above the tree line because, of course, I represent a fire hazard. But fire in anger I never have cause to breathe.
Not in recent years.
Well, not in recent years. Now, that's Herbert's place. That garden where he raises his fodder and flowers was as steep as any part of the hillside when he came, and all those great steps, which are called terraces, he made with his hands, apart from a few at the bottom, which the wild boar and I helped him to scoop out when we saw what he was up to.
What beautiful flowers.
But his lair, Thesaurus, that's not in keeping, surely.
Well, of course, George, you're accustomed to seeing the kind of lairs mankind builds in cities.
But with respect, that looks as though it had been thrown up by a dung beetle.
He sees a sort of virtue in that.
Does he?
I'll go ahead and ask if I can bring you. He does his devotions.
Devotions?
Well, he performs certain antics in his lair, and he doesn't like to be disturbed.
Thesaurus's friend Hermit came out and welcomed us warmly. He dug up fodder for us from his garden and could scarcely be restrained, though little was growing so early in the season. He invited us to peep into his lair. Two tiny flames lighted a wooden figure of a dead man, like the one mankind carried round the fields at home, and Hermit had a similar device hung round his neck. Thesaurus tried to explain these objects on our way back.
I confess I do not properly understand the meaning, but mankind believes there's another world besides this.
That is quite true. There are several. There are the worlds of the dinosaurs and of the whales and of the river trolls and, well, there may be others that I haven't heard of.
No, those are distant parts of this world, George. But they speak of a world to be encountered not through errantry but after death.
How is that possible?
I cannot say. But they believe there is a powerful being who has his lair above the sky and who looks after the fate of mankind.
How can any being look after fate? Fate can only be as it may be.
They believe the figure on the plank can change their fate in a favourable direction. And after death, revive them for another bout of life elsewhere.
But we have seen their skulls on the floor of the forest in the Old Kingdom with tall grass growing out of their eye sockets.
Well, apparently the plank man is capricious. He's not disposed to revive everybody. All this they call theology.
Well, thank you. That's very instructional. It's the sort of thing that might be useful to you, Amalric, when you become king and have to deal with mankind.
Yes, Uncle George.
I confess I do not properly grasp it, and I've given a very poor account. But somehow it's from such beliefs that Hermit derives the joy and the generosity which you've seen today, and the peace and friendship he enjoys with all living creatures. This apparently is enjoined by the plank man.
But the pink species of mankind carry these planks into battle.
I often cogitate about that, George. I do not know. But this one of mankind, Hermit, is as dear to me as any dragon.
He is most agreeable.
And it seems that the plank which guides them to war guides him to peace. I've been thinking over the king's invitation, George. I think I should rather like to come back with you for a visit to the kingdom.
Oh, marvellous.
Everyone will be delighted.
Living too long away from one's own kind, you know, there's always a danger. One may become slightly eccentric. You're not pressed to start for a week or two?
No.
Because Hermit especially wants me to meet a man like himself who'll be passing this way.
Does he also live alone?
Yes, but not at one place. He's what's called an itinerant preacher.
Is that like a dragon errant, Uncle Thesaurus?
Well, insofar, Alcuin, as I gather he alternates between tramping and trumpeting.
Does he joust with whales and form attachments?
That I don't know. I think it's unlikely, at any rate, that he jousts with whales.
As it happened, we saw Hermit's friend arrive, watching from the top of some rocks. He passed beneath without noticing us, a compact little creature wrapped up in his thoughts. We were greatly surprised when we found out he had indeed come for a joust. On the day we'd been invited to meet him, we heard on approaching the menacing voices of the two of them upraised in Hermit's lair. They were fighting. They knocked over the plank figure and extinguished the little flames. Then the pair of them shot through the mud wall, locked in each other's arms. They rolled over, kicking and flailing, bouncing down the terraces, flattening the flowers and the growing fodder until they hit the stream at the bottom. Rising from the water, the itinerant preacher spotted us watching and fled in terror. Hermit was sitting head down with his back to us. Thesaurus quietly lifted some dung from a heap and patched the hole in the wall of his lair. The man turned and spoke, and they both laughed a little. Then Hermit dropped his head again, and Thesaurus led us away.
A theological dispute, it seems.
I will now speak of our arrival home, and of the changed circumstances we there encountered. When we rounded the shoulder of the mountain, we saw, to our astonishment, a large army of mankind encamped on the plain between the city and the forest. And we discovered our kindred not on our own territory, but across the valley, in the part of the forest normally left for mankind.
They look unlike any army we have seen before, Your Majesty.
Kellor thinks that they are from the north. Thesaurus, I believe you haven't met Kellor, George's second in command. And Balin, who commands the errands, who have come to join us?
They are most extremely uncouth, these warriors, with raucous voices and great manes like lions, and so ignorant of custom that they came banging and shouting in the forest and awoke absolutely everybody out of hibernation.
Kellor's guards quickly flushed them out of our forest, but even on their own ground they behaved in such a rowdy way that everybody was up and about early, and we ate all the young shoots at first growth. I was compelled, in search of fodder, to lead our kindred across the valley. Kellor has reinforced the guard to keep mankind out of our own part of the forest, and we have had to dissuade them from coming here.
So you're now in occupation of your own forest and theirs as well?
We are, Thesaurus.
I see. But all this does not portend any change in the friendly policy of the King of Mankind towards you. It's merely that he made an unfortunate choice in the army to be stationed between the city and the forest.
Not quite. He has every right to station an army there, but he has never before done so. Hitherto, he has mustered armies for expeditions overseas, on the plain at the other side of the city, deliberately avoiding this ground. Now, Kellor tells me, the ground on the other side of the city is also swarming with warriors. A dusky species mounted on camels and elephants. Yes, Toram?
One of mankind has come to see Thesaurus.
No, none of mankind here.
He asked for you by name.
But I know of only one of mankind who can make himself understood to dragons.
Well, there are several in the city and a few of the creatures in the fields in a very limited and rather comic way.
Well, then, perhaps we'd better seek elucidation. Perhaps I should see this emissary from mankind.
Please do that.
It seems, Your Majesty, fate is more finely balanced than we had feared. My visitor from mankind, who came just now from the city, is my neighbour, whom we'd thought to have left behind in the wilderness. He hastened here, overtaking us by the use of vessels on river and sea, because of a vision he had of a most terrible conflict.
Well, yes, rumours are abroad because of the events we've described.
It's rather more than rumour. While George and your sons were visiting me, my friend Hermit had an altercation with another of mankind who makes it his occupation to preach and rave against dragons.
Oh, ravings burn no forests.
Indeed. But I am alarmed at the reason why this itinerant preacher chose this place as fertile ground for his ravings. Your friend, the king, it seems, has long been ill and is now at the point of death.
I'm sorry.
And his son, the prince, who apparently has been the effective ruler for months past, will succeed to the throne any day now. He is intent to begin his reign with a great campaign.
Their military commanders have always been most cautious in their advice.
Indeed. This young creature prefers to listen to less practical counsellors, among whom our dire acquaintance, the itinerant preacher, though lately arrived, has quickly risen in eminence. They murmur that it is intolerable to his glory that being, as he soon shall be, emperor of all the cities of the earth, he should suffer his capital city to be menaced by dragons.
We do not want his city. We cannot feed on wood and stone. Have they forgotten the Battle of the Forest? Do they not learn from their mistakes?
Often, I am afraid, sir, not. But we must remain calm ourselves and aim by our restraint to foster what is rational in them.
The old king of mankind was a most rational creature. His waning is a great blow.
All of them are capable of some sanity if encouraged. My friend Hermit came here and has clarified our understanding. With your permission, I will reciprocate by visiting mankind at dawn and for a beginning at least explain our occupation of this part of the forest, which has indeed been misrepresented.
Please undertake the mission.
Quiet. Listen.
What does that mean, Thesaurus?
It means the king is dead. The king is dead. The prince is king.
George, resume your command forthwith. Have the army stand to. May your mission, Thesaurus, be favored by fate.
I will now speak of Thesaurus's mission to mankind and its unforeseen outcome. Thesaurus refused an escort, but when he had started across the open ground, George, Calor, Amalric and Balin moved quickly through the woods and joined the permanent guard Calor had posted along the edge of the trees close to the unruly army encamped between the forest and the city gate. Thesaurus would have to pass through these warriors, but first he crossed the fields where our old neighbours, grown apprehensive, stopped working at his approach and fled in alarm when he called out to them in what he took to be the language of mankind. His speech threw the unruly army into convulsions of laughter. At his first words to them, puffs of breath in the morning air, they laughed and jeered and banged their weapons. I didn't see quite how violence began, so thickly was he surrounded, but some of them flung a great net and trammelled him up, and many fell upon him with their spikes. A line of dragons appeared at the edge of the forest and charged, breathing fire. The warriors reeled back, leaving their smouldering comrades on the ground, and Thesaurus thrashing in the net. Until then I hadn't been able to pick out George and Amalric and Calor. They had circled behind the warriors, who now, finding themselves surrounded and cut off from retreat to the city, dropped their arms. Thesaurus limped clear with spikes sticking in his scales and dragging the net behind him. A machine on the city wall hurled a boulder, which one of the dragons had to move quickly to avoid. Warriors were standing ready by machines all along the wall, and a few late ones were arriving and bending the beams. George walked towards the machine that had fired and stood looking up at it. A boulder struck quite close to him.
Come on! It singed a few!
George had not turned from the machine to see flame hit the edges of the surrounded army. The new king came to the wall and spoke an order. The warriors stepped clear of their machines, and George, turning back towards the surrounded army, said,
"All right, Calor, let them go."
Thesaurus, do join us. How are your poor wounds?
Mere pricks, ma'am. Except I've lost the use of one ear, and I'm obliged to turn my head to catch what's said in a way which may cause strangers to consider me eccentric.
However, your mission seems to have done the trick, if not quite in the manner we foresaw.
Well, yes.
The new king this morning withdrew the warriors from the plain on our side of the city, and George confirms your friend's information that he has shipped the unruly army some distance away along the coast.
But at the same time, sir, they have not removed the excess of war machines from the walls. Their dusky armies with elephants and camels remain encamped on the other side of the city. And, of course, the army whose edges we singed could always be shipped back.
But given this concentration, George, he would hardly have been able to disperse it in the few days since you chastised him.
We must be patient. The young king foolishly committed himself to banishing us from the sight of his capital. He now has to find a way of retracting without injury to his pride or power.
Dog, the fodder of our large cheese and rice, who sighed for our dins and the starvation of old men, we call us. Offender of the race, Imperator.
Within a few days of the skirmish, the king of mankind had made known his wish to parley with my father on the plain between the city and the forest. And his retinue had ridden out, watched by great numbers of mankind, from the top of the walls and the towers and the roofs. Beside the king on one side, a mounted warrior bore hoisted on a pole the beautiful coloured fabric which mankind takes into battle, and on the other, a man in a dark robe held aloft the plank man. At a signal from the king of mankind, one of his retinue had walked his horse forward and started to proclaim loudly, in what he took to be the language of dragons. Thesaurus turned his good ear towards the shouter, and made enough sense to convey the import to my father.
Ethnos, the said Carlos, imperator of each, all and every part, portion and parcel hereunto pertaining, terra marique, skies and seas, flies and fleas, homines, animales, et todos pisces, whatsoever,
Recedat,
Seigneur de Rhone, Rhine et Rome, and all lands soever thereto abutting.
Is that all he said?
In effect. Shall I ask him to proceed to the main verb?
Adjoining,
let him continue in his own way.
Maître de nuages et de vent, commander of hail, rain, and thunder, grand inquisitor of deserts,
oh, this rigmarole of titles.
Rex regorum, imperator imperatorum, caesar caesararum, abject only to unsightly dog.
But he does at least regard himself as being under orders of the great unseeing being who guards the fate of mankind.
Unsightly dog, fodder of our lives, cheese and rice, our bard and raver who sighed for our dins, and now in chalum smells, and of his great fragrance gave off his holy scent.
Holy saint, it's a sort of runner for the great being. It's our old friend, the itinerant preacher.
Amen. Wherefore, we Carlos Imperator, forfender of...
Aye.
Beseeching defrain the gross flagation and misfoil of omni-turmoil.
Anxious to avoid the ravages of general war.
To moot and embroach that misruption entres dois.
Propose that the issue between us...
Resolutatum in perpetuum...
should be resolved forever...
for agro solo.
By single combat.
Imperator, Rex Regorum, forbender of the...
So I...
debauch an avant on the mais fealty in grappler...
present my most trusty champion...
Sir Charge!
Sir Charge. Name like yours, George.
So in brief, what he proposes, Thesaurus, is that we should send a dragon to fight this warrior... very much in the way they play the game of knocking each other off their horses?
Yes, Your Majesty.
But one of mankind cannot stand up to a dragon. Was the king not at the wall when a mere detachment of dragons routed a whole army?
He is persuaded that his champion will prevail because of the protection he will enjoy from the great being who guards the fate of mankind.
What does your friend Hermit make of this?
He has deep faith in the great being, but does not share their belief that he will favor this enterprise.
What do they expect to be determined by the outcome?
The victor will dictate his terms as a victor would in war. It's a game, but more sensible at least than warfare. And most importantly, it offers the king of mankind a means of avoiding the war against us for which he ostentatiously prepared.
And which we, too, most dearly wish to avoid.
Then, sir, shall I forthwith detail a dragon to roast his champion?
Perhaps Your Majesty might offer the honor to Balin.
Or possibly a Malric, Your Majesty.
I'm not sure that it would be suitable for a Malric.
Just a moment, please. We must not annihilate this champion in a puff of smoke. If we are to have a happy outcome, we must refrain altogether from vaporizing the poor chap, whatever he calls himself.
Sir Charge.
We shall only incur fear and enmity if with such ease we humiliate the young king and expose the great being in whom mankind places such reliance as an absent help in time of trouble.
Quite so, quite so.
We must win, of course, but without being ruthlessly overwhelming, make it not too brief an entertainment for mankind perched along the wall and permit this little surcharge chap some honour in defeat. Now, I wonder, George, if you could possibly call to mind a dragon capable of proceeding on those measured lines.
I am ever, sir, at your command.
On the day of the contest, mankind thronged the wall top and the towers and roofs of the city, and the distant undulation of their voices rose into a great wave of sound. As Sir Charge rode from the city gate, attended by a retinue who bore aloft the plank and the beautiful cloth. Sir Charge came forward alone. White horse, white robe with the red emblem, lance held upright, catching the sun. Uncle George moved forward from the edge of the forest, and the multitude of mankind assembled on the walls and towers and roofs shifted and shouted as though they'd never seen a dragon before. Sir Charge lowered his lance, and his brave horse, nostrils flared, thundered across the open ground in a charge which George evaded with a late sidestep. Sir Charge was close to us as he turned and composed himself to repeat the attack. Horse and man together looked quite powerful, and I had a foreboding that it would be dangerous to allow the contest to go on for too long. George had moved into the centre of the ground, and Sir Charge, now with his back to us, rode at him again.
Straight lines always,
Callor said, and horse and man thundered at George as directly as though they'd been on a road. But all the time, George was moving slightly sideways across their line of advance with short, beautifully judged steps, so that the horse, pulled into a tightening turn, stumbled, and the king's champion was thrown. George waited for a moment to avoid disrespect, and then, as though excusing himself, walked away towards the city wall. Mankind received him well, and while the retinue came riding out to Sir Charge, George made one or two slight capers of battle, which, restrained as they were, so moved mankind to laughter that some fell off the rooftops, which further increased the merriment.
I think it's going well, Thesaurus.
It's going very well, Your Majesty.
They have remounted the champion, sir.
Is that all right, Callor?
I don't know, sir, exactly what rules govern these affairs.
Just continuing the jollifications, I think.
And certainly the mood had quite changed. George had rapidly become a favourite of mankind, and we, for our part, admired his brave opponent, whose retinue remained on the field in the clear expectation of having to set him on his horse again. The combat entered a phase of skirmish at close quarters near the palisades, part in jest and part in earnest, it seemed, like the set-tos between George and Amalric when my brother was younger. George did not, of course, breathe fire, nor did he parry with heavy blows, but when in a quick moment he saw his opponent off balance, he couldn't restrain himself from striking with his flank, knocking over the horse and sending the champion flying into the moat.
Callor, I think this is the right point to call it a day.
I'll try to attract his attention, sir.
But Callor did not succeed, because at that moment, two elephants came ambling out through the city gate with dusky warriors seated on platforms on their backs. They pranced about outside the palisades, the dusky warriors waving to the crowd, while Sir Charge's retinue fished him out of the moat and set him on a fresh horse, a black one, whose flanks shone with the rivulets which oozed from his robe. They gave him another lance, which he used as a prop, up to the ground, a spectator of the new proceedings. George, having at last caught Callor's signal, had started to stroll back, when the elephants turned and ambled in his direction. The dusky warriors gleefully hurled a shower of javelins at him, two of which stuck between his scales. George responded with a beautifully controlled breath of fire. Which singed the elephant's forefeet and so made them dance that the dusky warriors clung to their perches with such desperation that we could see the whites of their eyes. The elephants calmed, and their warriors now began to show their skill, manoeuvring their beasts to counter George's sinuous movements. And after that first shower, reserving their javelins for the best striking positions.
I think, sir, we should move out and make it clear the proceedings are over.
Yes, but not yourself, Callor, and not in force. Send one of your younger dragons to George, with my command to return.
Grendel, you heard the king's order.
Yes, sir.
George really should not joust with pachyderms at his age.
He can give them a proper blast of fire if he needs to, ma'am.
But Uncle George obviously didn't intend to. He had fulfilled with his good nature and skill in combat his mission of restoring friendship with mankind, and it would have been contrary to his purpose and character to have spoiled a pleasant afternoon by incinerating his opponents. At that moment, he increased his popularity by evading one charging elephant and sideswiping the other so that several of the warriors on one beast, thrown off their aim, flung their javelins through the warriors on the other. Sir Charge sat clear of his retinue, his back turned on their shouted exhortations, and concentrated on preventing his horse from shying whenever the elephants lumbered in his direction. Nobody took much notice of him. Uncle George and the elephants fought a most engaging contest, and the dusky warriors endeared themselves to mankind, and indeed to us, by their cheerful enthusiasm for the contest, even though several of their number now lay on the ground. They had got two more javelins into George's hide, and he was tiring. He was moving more slowly, standing off for longer, and his permanent limp was now conspicuous. The contest had moved quite close to the city gate.
I await permission, Your Majesty, to move out and end the proceedings.
I have sent him my command, Kellor.
Even so, sir, I await your permission to move out.
At that moment, while everybody looked to my father, the contest ended. George stepped aside as the two elephants charged. They met head on, and the collision flung the warriors high into the air. Then all mankind was laughing, and it was seen that one of the elephants had caught a warrior in its trunk and lifted him back to his perch. The other beast, which had had the worst of the collision, was reeling about, which added to the jollity, and the surviving warrior made gestures of salutation to Uncle George, to ourselves, at the distance of the forest edge, and to the hosts of mankind, some of whom, now the fun was over, began to slither down from the roofs and towers. Sir Charge rode in fast from behind and drove his lance between George's scales.
He's down.
I await, Your Majesty, your permission to move out.
Move nobody, Kellor. They'd kill him before we could cross the plain.
Sir Charge's lance, at full tilt, had found some vital spot. They got George to his feet and led him through the city gate.
Laudate Dominum! Omnes gestes, laudate eum, omnes populi.
Hail be to the father, and to the land, and to the horses' hopes. Amen.
Well, thesaurus, what is to be expected now?
If he lives, they will make known tomorrow their terms for his ransom.
And if he dies?
They would still seek to impose terms by virtue of their victory. But they would know that this would command less force without a hostage.
So they have good reason to try to preserve his life?
Oh, they have.
Then there is nothing to be done immediately. We will meet and take counsel in the clearing when the sun goes down.
The first bonfires of celebration sprang up in the city square in front of the great pointed building shortly after nightfall. The tang of smoke and the sounds of rejoicing came and went on a freshening breeze. The fires silhouetted the towers and the war machines along the wall, but the plain and the fields were lighted only by the stars, and we heard before we saw the approach of Thesaurus's friend Hermit, panting as he stumbled over rows of growing fodder. His first words to Thesaurus brought great relief.
Wonderful news! George's wounds are not as grave as we feared. His life is not in danger.
Learn what else you can, Thesaurus. In the meantime, let us begin our counsel. I wish my aims to be clearly understood by all of you. They are, first, to secure George's return. Second, to continue to live here and at peace with mankind. Third, to preserve the integrity of the kingdom, so far as this may be compatible with the other two aims.
You are prepared, then, to cede Dragon territory, Your Majesty?
If a penalty should be exacted, Balin, that would be the least to pay.
A smaller territory would, of course, support a smaller army, Your Majesty. And the balance of threat would be disturbed, to the detriment of your kingdom and the prospect of peace.
Kellor, I hope we shall not have to make the choice, which would be the more painful to me, because I am alone to blame for bringing us to a position where a choice may have to be made.
Nobody was opposed.
We all assented.
It seemed right at the time, sir.
You blame yourself too harshly. You were right in seeing in this spectacle a means of demonstrating strength and restraint, and thus of restoring harmony with mankind. George had most gracefully and skillfully carried out your intentions when he turned back to indulge in combat with the pachyderms against your express command.
With respect, Your Majesty, we did not misunderstand. The challenge was to single combat. To fight a warrior mounted on a horse supported by a retinue of half an army and reinforced by two elephants bearing a horde of mankind from distant lands, how could this be termed single combat?
It could not, Balin. but you only rephrase what has already been said. By remaining in the field and engaging these further rivals, however genially, George accepted, by implication, the legitimacy of their intervention.
I doubt whether it would have occurred to him quite those words, sir.
Surely, Father, there can be no doubt that he did not accept, by implication or otherwise, to be felled by an unheralded charge from the rear.
Certainly he did not.
Exactly.
The contest ended when the elephants collided and the surviving warrior held up his hand. Mankind was slithering down from the towers and rooftops. They knew the joust was finished, and Uncle George knew it was finished. In combat, he would never neglect any quarter. He has eyes everywhere.
He has indeed.
He misses nothing.
He was not defeated. He was waylaid.
Yes.
Surely, Father, it is not a question of accepting penalties, but of punishing a crime.
We can reduce their city to ashes.
Yes.
Remind them and demand his freedom.
And if they refuse, Balin?
Then reduce their city to ashes.
Yes.
Silence!
Yes.
I command silence!
The king invited you to a council, not to a mutiny.
I beg your pardon, Father. I spoke rashly.
You must not allow your love for George, my son, and your indignation at the dishonor that has been done to him to unseat your judgment.
Nevertheless, a subject has been raised about which I need to be informed. Kellor, would an attack on the city be feasible?
Yes, sir. There is a weak point in the old part of the city where an arm reaches in from the sea and vessels pass between the dwellings. There are also several low places around the wall which might be surmounted.
What loss might we expect to suffer in such an attack?
At normal times, half our force. Now that the city has been reinforced by machines and dusky armies assembled on the plain beyond, we should lose many more.
So it is not a reasonable operation of war?
No, sir.
But if any harm should befall George at their hands...
Yes, Palin.
Then, sir, it might become a requirement of honor.
It is a contingency we trust will not arise, and which we must do nothing to provoke. Thesaurus, don't hang about in the shadows. Have you learned from your friend what is happening in the city?
Well, they're celebrating a victory, which the itinerant preacher and his like tell them came about through the unseen hand of the great being. They wash the feet and kiss the robe of the preacher, and he promises them boundless victories against dragons.
How much is the king of mankind now influenced by him?
Well, Hermit says not greatly. The rout of the unruly army the other day was the first encounter the king had known with dragons, and very salutary. As he said in his challenge, he saw the joust as an alternative to general war, and the military leaders who served his father have from the beginning urged peaceful courses upon him. My friend believes they are now pressing him to use his victory as a means of displaying magnanimity, of waiving ransom and thus re-establishing friendship.
Then what do you counsel, Thesaurus?
None of mankind is permanently sane. Some are permanently demented, but most are sane and demented by turn. It takes little to unhinge them, and the day's events have deranged the common populace. They will return to reason. Those who tonight shout hatred of dragons are the same who this afternoon cheered poor George in the contest. We must not allow ourselves to be provoked, and we must permit time to pass so the phase of reason may return.
And George, then, would remain their captive during the period of returning to sanity?
Yes.
In what danger does he stand?
None. My friend saw him. He was being cared for out of sight of the celebrating populace.
Then we will wait. Kellor, keep the army stood to round the edge of the forest.
Yes, sir.
But make it clear that no one is to move further except at my express order.
Yes, sir.
For yourself, Kellor, would you and Balin please consider what might be done to rescue George if events do not develop as we hope?
By now, the light of the bonfires in the city was visible through the trees, even from the clearing. And as we returned to the edge of the forest, the noise of celebration swelled. The breeze carried away the smoke of the bonfires, and we could see the towered city as clearly as by day. Mankind were scampering about the roofs as though having climbed there in the afternoon. Some had formed a permanent attachment to elevation, like the apes. Several fell, one into a bonfire, sending up a shout of sparks and laughter.
They really are demented.
They are, Balin. Did you speak, Amalric?
I was saying to Kellor, Father, that their warriors have remained by their machines along the city wall.
That is to be welcomed. At least their army remains under discipline. What's happening now?
They seem intent on getting half the population to the roof of the pointed building in the city square. They're hauling each other up on ropes.
What sort of rite is this, Thesaurus?
None I know of, sir. Just part of the general roistering.
Somebody threw more wood on the bonfires, making smoke which obscured our view. It blew clear long enough for us to see another tumble of men landed on the roof, and the ropes flung down again.
The warriors have left the machines.
Are they quelling the revelry, Keller?
I do not know, sir.
Maybe that the clerics frown upon their swarming on the roof of the pointed building.
The smoke thinned, and we saw those on the roof pulling again on the ropes. George's severed head was hauled up and stuck on a pinnacle.
Make no move. Order all to stand fast.
Caidon, repeat the order down the line. Everyone to stand fast.
Your errand, Balin. You are clear about the order?
I am clear about the order, sir.
Sir, if I may speak.
Speak, Thesaurus.
This frightful thing cannot have been the will of those of mankind who have been so long our friends. Let us not, because of the outrage we have suffered, commit outrage. Let us not, because of our own grief, throw the world into mourning.
I hear you, Thesaurus.
Amalric.
But Amalric had gone. We saw the fire of his breath hit the palisade in a shower of sparks, once and then twice more. The palings caught light and broke about his shoulders as he crashed through. Then he was across the wet moat and we lost sight of him in the darkness.
They will kill him too now.
Your Majesty.
I have given my order, Kellor. I will speak if and when it is to be changed.
Warriors, with the crowd swarming behind them, had returned to their catapults and were firing boulders into the dark, dry moat between the break in the palisade and the wall. Archers in the towers fired arrows whose flaming tails cut across the smoky light of the bonfires. More distant machines were slewed round until everyone along the whole section of the wall was pounding the small area where Amalric had broken through. Then they ceased, and in the silence we heard only the distant crackle of the neglected bonfires and our own breathing. Something we hadn't seen before, a flaring ball was fired from three of the machines in turn to illuminate the ground. We saw the heaped outline of the many boulders with which they had bombarded the small patch, and warriors with flaring torches were lowered from the wall to kick over the stones and look for Amalric's body. The rest of mankind returned to revelry. It was now very cold, and a stiffening wind whipped up bonfires which had been dying in many parts of the city. We didn't detect a longer low line of fire until Kellor said,
"He has broken in by the harbour, sir. A street of the old city is beginning to burn."
But haven't the machines just...
"He was not there, sir. He must have slipped back through the palisade and moved round in the darkness. He is fighting into the old city from the waterfront."
"Is he to be left to fight alone?"
"No, ma'am. He is not. Errants!
In line, yes! Forward!"
"Kellor, cut off the errants from the city. Use what force you must."
"I regret, sir. I have no force at my command for such a purpose. Our armies are moving out from the old forest and crossing the plain. May I tell them that you commend their initiative and confirm their action?"
"Are you as mad as mankind? You told me an attack on the city would cost us more than half our force. That would be the end of our nation. Has this outrage changed the arithmetic?"
"It has not, sir. But matters of honor are not to be calculated by arithmetic. I take my leave, sir."
Kellor went, and the whole of the army in our sector, bearing me along with them, and leaving my father and Thesaurus in despair at the edge of the forest. The dark plain swarmed with dragons moving on the city. The palisades flared at a score of points, and the machines ranged along the wall and the archers in the towers fired incessantly. Balin and the Errant stormed over the wall at the low point Amalric had feinted to attack, and fought their way round towards him, firing buildings and suffering and inflicting frightful losses. Kalor's main force, in which I was swept along, circled the city in a wide arc, overwhelming the dusky armies encamped at the far side, and fighting up the steep streets to the city square and the great pinnacle building. I had been struck by an arrow, and Kalor, who saw everything, shoved me into a kind of cave constructed as part of a building, and posted two dragons, also wounded, to guard me. Everything was burning. I saw warriors of mankind firing arrows and hurling javelins from towers and rooftops and holes in the walls. Their machines, which had been turned to fire into the square, flung boulders into the ranks of dragons. Roused by pain, I would fall into a sort of sleep and awaken. Creatures occurred in a random way, as they might in a dream. Once, when I opened my eyes, I saw a dreadful melee of mankind hacking with weapons and dragons striking with bared claws. And at a point where they fell apart, I saw Thesaurus's friend Hermit moving through them as though immune from danger, his hands spread wide like the plank figure. I thought I saw Amalric, and in my delirium, I found myself trying to remember whether or not he'd been killed at the wall. I asked the dragons who guarded me.
They've killed a lot of us at the wall.
They're paying for killing a lot of us.
But then he broke into the old city. It was he who set it alight.
We set the old lot alight.
That's what we came for, to set it alight.
In another moment of awareness, I saw Thesaurus, and I knew that he hadn't been killed, but that there was some reason why I should not expect to see him here. He was moving about behind the fighting, quite lost. A group of mankind assailed him in a rapid sortie from a side alley. He endured their blows, but then his temper snapped, and like a creature gone mad, he tore into them with his claws, heedless of their weapons, forcing himself deeper and deeper into their ranks, trampling over the slain. A hermit stood before him, his arms outstretched. Thesaurus felled him with a single blow. He stood still, it seemed, for quite a long time. Then mankind fell upon him and he offered no resistance.
Uncle Thesaurus! Uncle Thesaurus! He can't hear me!
Can't hear yourself think in this din.
It's his ear! His wounded ear!
Who's ear?
Thesaurus! He's deaf in one ear!
Thesaurus sank, and a wave of mankind's warriors swept across his body. I saw no more until I was roused by Emish, one of my guards.
Alcuin! Alcuin! We've got them! We've captured the machines!
I was quite blinded by the glare of the fires, which had grown mightily in the time, long or short, that I was dozing. Then I saw that the big machines, which had prevented the advance of dragons across the square, had been overturned.
Your brother Amalric got amongst them. He's there, see?
What?
Never mind that. Watch this. This is a historic moment. This is mankind's last stand.
The warriors of mankind had formed a semicircle at the foot of the broad steps leading up to the pinnacled building, with now only arrows and javelins and bolts from smaller machines to fire into our ranks. The stone buildings round the square, their interiors ablaze, stood like stolid spectators with square red eyes waiting to see the final assault.
Forward!
Forward!
Forward! Charge!
The whole force of dragons swept forward, and mankind was forced to retreat through the great door of the pinnacle building. As they attempted to swing it shut, three dragons flung their bodies into the closing gap. They fell, crushed, but the door swung open again, and a dragon whom I knew but didn't recognize charged through, followed by others.
The king's inside!
The king of mankind? Is that his lair?
No, our king!
Our king?
Your father! He just led the charge through the door!
But I thought we left him in the forest.
That's the last of mankind incinerated in there!
leapt through the apertures in the walls, and the dragons who had fired the interior tumbled down the steps. They rose. One was indeed my father. The roof exploded into flame and fell, showering the square with stone and blazing wood.
Get out! Firewind! Get out of the city!
Drove sparks and burning embers high through the streets, round the square and all over the city. Fire belched out to join fire.
Come on, young'un, get out!
Emish goaded me on with angry words, roughly shouldering me over obstacles as we swarmed over fallen dragons and mankind and crashed through burning wooden buildings. I saw a long white wall on which flames threw a shadow of moving dragons, which looked like a great heaving sea, and this sea was suddenly shattered as though by a volcano as the walls split into a thousand pieces. Some of us escaped through the gate, some at breaches in the wall, but many were killed leaping from high points. Many were caught by the fires which had now become one, towering high above the city, whipped up by the wind and drawing in a greater wind of such fury that we were knocked over on the plain below. I saw great pieces of buildings and the bodies of mankind and dragons sucked high into a single mighty fire which reddened the clouds and illuminated every horizon around, mountain, forest and sea. Rain fell in a shower shortly after dawn. A fine grey ash lay over field and forest. The rain didn't wash it away, but instead brought heavier particles which the fire had flung into the atmosphere. There was no flame now over the black ruins of the city, but a column of dense yellow smoke, and round the walls a pall of grey smoke denser than fog. Some of mankind who dwelt on the land were putting up their lairs which had been flattened by the firewind and the passage of the dragon armies. I think, like us, they were too numb to care whether they might be killed. None looked up or spoke as Amalric, who had been out to the headland, passed by, carefully skirting the ruined fields, as had always been our custom to avoid damaging the growing fodder.
There were several vessels standing off the estuary, Father, but they turned as I watched and sailed towards the horizon.
Thank you, Amalric.
Do you think they had arrived from overseas, or had they put out from harbour before our attack gathered force?
I have no means of knowing, Calor.
I think we can take it, Your Majesty, that they won't return.
Very well.
But there does remain the army of unruly warriors whom the King of Mankind shifted up the coast.
Mm. What of them, Balin?
We cannot, reduced as we are, allow such a force to remain intact.
How much further must we go? My subjects, such as are left of them, are not errants thirsting for endless combat?
Of the errants whom I had the honor to command in your service, only seven are left to thirst for anything.
Forgive me, Balin.
I should need a number from your own army. Not many, if we strike early and achieve surprise.
Kellor?
I agree with Balin, son.
Then give him what you can. Have you formed any assessment yet of our losses?
I believe we have lost 3/4 of the army, and more die from wounds every hour.
May I be excused, sir? Time presses.
Good luck, Balin. Amalric, you stay here.
Sir.
In the afternoon, the great yellow column above the ruined city subsided, and the skirt of grey smoke that had hung round the walls became thinner. A black cloud of vultures dropped into it. From mid-morning, dragons in ones and small groups had gone to search for their dead by the city wall. Even now we could scarcely see them through the smoke, but we could tell when they moved because the vultures rose into the sky and settled again further round the wall.
I ought to go and look for my brother. Are you coming, young'un?
Father, may I go with Emish?
Are both of you fit to walk so far?
I believe so, Father.
Then go. Yes, Kellor.
The body of Emish's brother was not among those that lay broken on the ground or floating in the moat. And it wasn't until the next day that the stone had cooled enough to permit us to enter the city. Dragons and mankind lay heaped in thousands, black as logs and small as dwarfs.
It shrunk them to nothing. They looked very big when the flames sucked them into the sky, but they come down shrunk.
It's a good job we were near the gate, young'un.
And for me that I had you to help me out.
Otherwise we'd have been shrunk too. Mm. I'd have been shrunk to your size and you'd have been shrunk to the size of a rabbit. We were lucky to be near that gate. And we were lucky that our runes were bad enough to put us out of the fight, but not too bad to prevent us scampering away from a roasting. Ah, it was a lucky night all round.
Only some walls remained of the great pinnacled building, but gold which had flowed molten from inside lay in a cascade from the gaping doorway to the foot of the steps.
Now, what do you make of this, young'un?
What is it?
It's a female of mankind. See, that way up. Like a short tree trunk holding an infant. See, like a little thick branch stuck across it. It's fused them together.
I could not pity these corpses, but their cross form evoked the memory of Hermit, seeking with outstretched hands to still the raging battle, and of the blow with which Thesaurus felled him in the bewilderment of his own last moments.
Nah, don't waste your tears on them, young'un. They asked for it when they hoisted George's head up. It was a preposterous thing to do, hoisting George's head up there.
Yes.
I've heard that the King of Mankind was not for hoisting George's head up, or even for lopping it off. But the mob done it. Has your dad said anything about that?
I don't believe he knows.
And then the King of Mankind lived in a special lair, they say, with floors of coloured stone and sprays of water shooting up. Well, we never saw that.
It must be in a different part of the city.
Wherever it was, it's not there now, is it?
No.
Nor the King of Mankind. It'll be just another of these shrunken logs. But gold-plated, perhaps, at one end, where his crown fused on his head.
I see.
Well, let's make our way back.
Shall we not look for your brother?
No. You can make out the melted features of some of these shrunken logs. Well, if he's like that, I'd sooner not find him.
No.
I'd rather remember him as he was.
Yes.
He was just about your age, young'un, when we came to this kingdom after the previous dust-up. I have a clear memory of him then, and also as a handsome, grown dragon. That'll suffice.
I will now speak of the address made by my father to our populace, to the widowed and the orphaned, to the wounded and the well, to the remnants of the army, and the last of the errants.
My dear friends, I have sought in my reign to do what was right and prudent at every step. But because of the limit of my wisdom, I have now, in the end, committed the unpardonable. My father, who led us here, enjoined upon me a policy of peace. He had lost a kingdom, sacrificed half our nation, and destroyed a million of mankind for the sake of a dispute about a river crossing. Forewarned by what I had seen and strengthened in my resolve by his words of self-rebuke, I have nevertheless repeated his error for the sake of a dispute which began with even less substance. No, no, no,
no. That's too harsh a judgment altogether, sir.
It is indeed too harsh a judgment. I know it is not your wish, my lord, to apportion blame. But events were brought about, firstly, by the madness of mankind, and secondly, by the indiscipline of your subjects, who contravened your expressed commands.
I myself joined in the battle I had forbidden, and so did the wise and gentle Thesaurus. We were all swept into the culmination of this disaster, as though by the fire wind itself. We might perhaps have avoided this particular succession of events, but we should not have avoided the end. That was inevitable when we chose to dwell in proximity to mankind.
But we stopped here in the first place because we could go no further. And thanks to your wisdom, we lived in growing amity until in their sudden dementia.
Precisely. This dementia is in the nature of mankind. Thesaurus, who loved them, knew it well, and had forebodings in our first days here of what has come to pass. We have all, at some time, felt these misgivings. It was my duty, once we had rested, to lead you to a safer place. And my failure to do so was no less an error of judgment than that of the new and inexperienced King of Mankind in bringing on a battle which has destroyed his world. I crave such pardon, as you can find in your hearts to grant me.
Oh, sir.
Thank you, but you do not know the full consequences. We must leave this kingdom.
But we won the battle. We extinguished mankind.
And we did it according to plan. It's their territory we've got to singe in this time.
Kalor, would you explain?
Yes, sir. It is true that we destroyed the armies the king of mankind had assembled here from all parts of the earth. And Balin, as you know, has just returned from destroying up the coast the uncouth warriors who started the trouble. We believe there is no remaining army of mankind within reach of us. There may be none left on earth.
Why should we leave, then?
Because we can't be certain. It was, at one time, part of our folklore to speak of the Battle of the Forests as one in which all the armies of mankind were annihilated. That was rather an overstatement, since you have just had to annihilate them again. However, if enough of mankind does still exist, they will not allow this, once the greatest city on earth, to remain undisputed. If they should return in numbers, we ourselves are too few to defend this territory.
Then why wait for them, sir? Send out scouts to find them if any remain, and descend with sudden force, just like Balin did, and wipe them out.
That greatly appeals, Emic. But even if there were armies within reach, we could not be sure of catching them by surprise and in the open. They could escape beyond our pursuit in their ships, or they could take refuge in their fortified cities, which, since we shall never again attempt to force one by assault, could only be taken by long sieges.
We would, in a word, reduce ourselves to the endless warfare which, through a flaw of the brain, is the lot of mankind. We must not be drawn in. We must get away from them.
But they breed so fast and scurry about so, Your Majesty. Where might we go that's free of them?
Inland. Thesaurus said, and all the much-travelled errants agree, that mankind lives only close to the sea or along broad rivers. The great interiors are inhabited only by creatures with whom we can live in peace.
We should get away from mankind.
That's right enough. We don't want to stay here now with memories and the stink that blows from the city.
But it's what you might call an ironical fate, isn't it, sir? When we won the battle with such glory, to have to retreat now as though we'd lost it?
That is the final penalty of my misjudgment. I will make what amends I can by leading you to a new kingdom, as I should have many years ago. And when that is done, you may well wish to replace me. My abdication will be at your disposal.
I will now speak of the fate of my noble brother Amalric.
I commanded you, Amalric, to reflect upon your action. And I must now warn you of the grave import of your reply.
Thank you, Father. I am filled with remorse and sorrow at the grievous harm I have brought to our nation. At my despite of the long patience of your peaceful purpose, and at the hurt I have caused to be inflicted on mankind.
The wider blame is mine. Others, more mature than you, were no less insubordinate. But you, Amalric, are heir to the kingdom, and yours was the signal act.
Which I regret with all my heart. But if I had the choice again, I would not do other.
Knowing the consequences?
I do not believe that matters of honor can be resolved by weighing the consequences.
Have you weighed the consequences of your forthright answers?
I am content to accept my fate.
Which again is honor's simple answer.
I think without these simple answers, one would need the legendary wisdom of the great being in whom mankind believed.
Amalric, in my lifetime we have won 2 great victories on the field of honor, to such effect that the dragon armies, which in my youth guarded the long frontier of the old kingdom from marsh to mountain, have been reduced to the numbers you see about us now. Another such victory, and we, the largest nation of dragons on earth, would be extinct. And perhaps someday, when our bones in the forest are powder in the grass, and our bones in the city crumbled with the fallen stone, perhaps then, creatures with a greater gift for survival would come to think that there had never been such things as dragons, and that we were, like the great being in whom mankind believed, a myth. that never trod the earth. Honor, of which you are an exemplar and a victim, was a supreme virtue in days gone by, and indeed we must account it a virtue still. But it is one which our survival can no longer afford. You are not alone in possessing it, but in you it shines brightest. Your presence would keep it kindled and glowing in many hearts. And one day, in some rash and glorious enterprise, our nation would finally perish. I banish you, Amalric, forever.
I will now speak in conclusion of the new kingdom we made deep in the interior, far from the wonted habitation of mankind. There is no great river in our new land, but many leaping streams rising in the snow of the mountains and sparkling cold throughout the summer. The upland meadows are bright with buttercups, and the breeze in the forest glades carries the laughter of the young. Several years passed after our arrival before the beauty of our new land began to brighten our hearts. We came in sorrow, defeated by victory, and my father, grieving for the thousands lost in battle and for Amalric banished by his will, grew more solemn. In the early years, we worked at clearing fire lines through the trees, from dawn to dusk and from the melting of the snow in spring until the last fall of leaves. Then, one autumn, our defenses were completed, and we all stood on the rocks above the forest and saw the pattern of the great maze we had made.
We can be confident we are impregnable now, Your Majesty, come what may.
Thank you, Kello. Thank you all.
And for the first time for many years, there was a great cheer for my father, and his subjects formed an aisle, and he passed between them in honor as he descended from the rocks. They hadn't asked for the abdication he had offered, but they had borne his rule with bare civility through the years of drudgery. I had become closer to him, I and Kalor and Toron, my friend who long ago in our early years used to ask Uncle George sharp questions about the tall tales he told us. Toron, like Thesaurus of old, had picked up a gleaning of the language of other creatures, including that of a small gaggle of mankind, too few to fear, who lived a day's march from the forest. He came back with some strange tales.
You remember Sir Charge, the mounted warrior who fell George?
We remember, Toron.
They have an absurd legend. They say that when the city burned, he was borne up by the firewind on his horse, and now sits at the right hand of the unseen being who guards the fate of mankind.
After a fashion.
And if ever an army of mankind arises again, he will descend from the sky and fight with them.
So one day, mankind may come at us from the sky.
Well, we too have our superstitions.
Like what?
I don't know.
But Toron did know, and changed the subject through tactfulness. Before our defences were complete, we were often alarmed by false rumours of the approach of armies of mankind, and a belief spread through the forest, arising I know not from where, that if they did come, Amalric would return. Among the young, his feat of breaking into the city alone grew to a legend that he had taken it unaided, and then to the belief that it was he who had held the river beach in the Battle of the Forest, which of course had happened before he was born. But the youngest generation of all had never seen a beach, nor a city, and to them, Amalric's name meant nothing.
But we have enjoyed 20 years of peace, Alcuin, and we are safe now from attack.
Yes, Father.
Rather unexciting for the young, perhaps. Do they find life dull?
I don't believe so, Father.
The nation is reviving, Alcuin. Before you die, we shall have almost regained the strength we enjoyed before the battle.
He watched our young dragons frolicking in the buttercup meadows, and the bounding squirrels, and a line of elephants which had followed us here, passing in the distance with their young. He looked beyond to the bastion of rocks where Kalor's lookout stood guard in the shimmering heat. And he said,
"It has turned out well, I think."
"It has, my lord. You have remade our world with your prudence and wisdom."
A few days later, and quite suddenly, his body failed him, and his mind clouded.
"Alcuin, your father is asking for you."
"Father?
Who is it?"
"Your son, my lord, the prince."
"Oh, I'm pleased you came,
Amalric.
It is Alcuin, my lord.
Oh, yes. Alcuin. My dear Alcuin. Where is Amalric?
He had to go on a journey, my lord.
Yes, I remember. Yes.
Quick march!
Amalric, by my father's permission, had remained with us in the forest by the ruined city for the few days between his sentence to banishment and our leaving for the interior. He said goodbye to nobody, but for everyone he had an apt word. And he left not with the army, but with those who walked more easily behind. We went over the shoulder of the hill where Fippa used to live, and down into the valley beyond, the way we had gone in the spring of the previous year, when we began our journey across the face of the earth with Uncle George. At the river where the path divides, Amalric slipped down as easily as though he was making a small detour, and crossed and climbed up the far side on the path that winds towards the clouds. The rest of us went on up the river valley. Felice, who used to weep at Uncle George's stories of unrequited love, now wept out loudly, and many wept silently. But most of us were too numbed by the events of the past days to be capable of weeping. High on the flank of the mountain, Amalric turned. He breathed in farewell two blasts of fire, scarcely audible at the distance and scarcely visible against the sky. Then he turned and was gone. And we, like an army of beetles in the valley, marched on towards the new kingdom. Nobody spoke except the old dragoness Fippa, who said,
"Who will collect my fodder for me now?"
That was Dragon by Don Howarth, with Robert Stevens as George, Alan Bennett, Thesaurus, Cyril Chaps, the King, Pauline Letts, the Queen, David Timpson, Amalric, and Stephen Thorne, the narrator, Alcuin. Young Alcuin, Jill Lidston, Torren, Elizabeth Lindsay, Felice, Jane Rosamond, Gayla, Catherine Herbert, Sybil, Christine Absalom, the Priest, Alan Dudley, Fippa, Sonia Fraser, Harold, Alexander John, Kaylor, John Rye, Balin, Michael Spice, Amick, John Hollis, Pons, Hayden Wood, Grendel, Stephen Garlick. Other warriors and dragons were played by John McAndrew, Joe Dunlop, and Alric Cotter. The technical team was David Greenwood, Anne Hunt, and Donald MacLeod. The play was directed by Richard Wertley.